production sort of starts taking over, you know, with like spandex metal bands that spend millions on an album. And then Nirvana comes out and it's like, no, you actually need, you know, two guitars and four people and that's it.
This is Up, Up, Down, Down, the show about the past and future of video games. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, a 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment, later Activision, is now co-founder of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
We're also very lucky to welcome Nevin Mergen. By day, Nevin designs wonderful apps at Panic, and by night, he designs wonderful games, such as Black Bar and The Incident. Hi, Nevin.
Hello.
So our topic today is retro games, not necessarily the games we loved when we were younger, although those are also wonderful, but the modern explosion in great indie games and to some degree AAA games that adopt that aesthetic of retro games. And the reason that we really wanted to have Nevin on, well, I mean, there's many reasons, but the reason that makes that a really great topic is that he's working on a game called Space Age, which is in this retro style. So I thought a great thing to start off with would be to ask Nevin, what's Space Age? What's that all about?
Space Age is a game that I've been working on with my game partner, Matt Comey. We made a game called The Incident about 3 years ago, and then this is our second game. And the game itself, I guess I've been describing it as a tactical adventure. It's retro in its graphics and in its gameplay, somewhat updated a little bit for the 2000 teens. But it's sort of a story-driven adventure type game, I would say.
I like that, tactical adventure. I'm not sure if those two things are normally combined, but from what I've seen of the game so far, it actually works better than... it's not something I would have thought of, so it's very cool. So it's in this retro style, which is obviously a very, maybe not obviously, but a very common thing that's been happening with indie games in the last few years. And one of the things I wanted to kind of talk about and think about is, what is it about that style that is driving a lot of indie developers to focus on building that kind of style? And I had sort of, Nigel and I had talked about this a little bit before, just over the years, and something I had never really thought of, but then when I heard it, it was kind of like, ding, a big thing, is that building 3D art for an entire world is insanely expensive. not to diminish, not to just go to the cost argument as being the first thing, but like that was one thing where it's just like, you know, being able to craft a loving 2D world is much more feasible for you, you know, as a small team. I mean, you're a game team of two, but even an indie game team of like, you know, maybe five people, it's way more, you know, plausible for them to create a wonderful, you know, sort of 2D look instead of 3D. Do you think that that's a big part of the popularity of the style?
I think the first time that I got a similar question to this, the person asking me was sort of very carefully phrasing it, because they didn't want to imply, which I'm sure is what you're trying to avoid, like it's easier, like it sounds as if it's lazier to do it that way. But I absolutely agree. It's much easier to do pixel art than it is to do, well, let me put it this way. It's much easier to do satisfactory pixel art than it is to do satisfactory 3D art.
Yeah, and I'm exactly like you mean. I'm not trying to even imply easy as like, you know, it's challenging, like getting, and that's something I want to talk about too, is like getting pixel art right is hard. For anyone who's not tried to represent something in a recognizable way in a very small number of pixels, it's super hard. But like the quantity of art, like how many, like, and maybe you don't know off the top of your head, but like how many textures or assets are there in a game like The Incident?
In The Incident, I mean, most of the game is in like four files, which really, in terms of you know, byte size, are probably, you know, under a megabyte total. It's a lot of little objects, like a few hundred little items, and then maybe about 80 to 100 frames of animation. So it's really not much. I guess I would say with pixel art, yeah, getting your style right and sticking to that style is the difficult part. But once you have that down, actually producing additional assets is way faster and way easier. Whereas with 3D, you only gain so much by defining your style. Somebody still has to sit down and, you know, put together a whole lot of polygons into an object. So that's what's easier about pixel art, I think.
I think the volume thing is pretty key, that it's not that an individual piece of pixel art is easy to make. It isn't. It's really difficult to make something that represents a character well in as few pixels as you've got with that stuff. But the fact that you can get away in those style of games with 4-frame walk cycles and stuff like that just gives you a huge leg up over more detailed content. There's, you know, yeah, maybe you'll spend as much time slaving over the 1 32 by 32 pixel sprite as someone's spending on their, you know, 1000 poly base model, but you don't have to then go and animate, you know, hundreds of different animations and all the blend transitions and everything to make that into an animated character. You can just be like, yeah, I'm just going to do that really hard pixel art thing 8 more times, and then I've got a walk cycle, and I'll just use that. You know, it's a nice leg up that way. Yeah.
One thing that's a little that you don't get in pixel art that you get in 3D art and like in kind of vectory art styles is that those can be procedural more easily. If you have a walk cycle, like a 3D walk cycle, you can sort of tweak its properties to get a character who's walking more slowly or with more weight or something like that. Whereas in pixel art, you can't really produce it procedurally. Computers do not know how to make it look good. Like if you start rotating things in pixel art, it looks like complete garbage.
Have you seen those research projects on then how they are trying to be able to scale up pixel art so it's higher def? Because like, you know, want to play an old game that's at low res, they want to scale it up in a smooth way that preserves the shapes. It's like computers just do not understand it. Like the state of the art is like really clever and still has some like kind of hilariously wrong results. So
yeah, the best thing that I've seen of procedural pixel art has been procedural lighting on sprites.
Oh yeah, I've seen some cool stuff on
you
that too.
Sort of define what the volume of your pixel layer might be, and then you can have actual light sources on it, and that looks like the final output looks like completely acceptable pixel art. I'm not sure how much work it takes to get there, but it seems worth trying, so that I like.
Yeah, that's very cool stuff. Something that also occurs to me that I think is more makes pixel art a really appropriate style for indie games is that, like you say, the art direction, the sort of style that you want to get, you know, getting that and then sticking to it is challenging. And when you are doing a AAA game with you know, hundreds of artists on it, that becomes way harder, especially if often in some of those games they outsource entire, like, oh, we're going to outsource all the vehicles to Kerplakistan, and then, but you want them to actually have the, you know, for pixel art, that would be challenging, I would expect.
Yeah, and that's one reason why a lot of AAA games end up looking, quote, realistic, because nobody will get fired for making something look too realistic, right?
Right.
Whereas sticking to a particular art style, yeah, that's, I mean, people are good at that. Granted, I'm not trying to say they're not. A lot of people are really good at matching style, but it's somewhat easier to make things look realistic than you just use, you know, photo textures and, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. I never really thought about that, but that makes a lot of sense, actually.
And it's harder to parallelize well. Even if you do have, you know, an art director that's defined a style and a few people that are good at matching that style, that doesn't necessarily parallelize well, right? You want to be able to get a large number of artists, some of whom may be working overseas remotely, to match the same art style. And so the more middle of the road you make the art style, the easier that's going to be.
Yeah, probably.
So Nevin, is there any particular tools that you use in order to do the art for these kind of games? So for anyone who doesn't know of the incident, you should go download it right now. It's on iOS and the Mac, I believe, but it's another sort of 8-bit art style game that has sort of the same art requirements in some ways as Space Age. So is there any tools that you use to do that, or is it just kind of like, you know, clicking in Photoshop?
Honestly, it's clicking in Photoshop. And I mean, I do have my workflow in Photoshop. I'm not like a slave to it. You know, if I had to work on somebody else's computer or something, that's totally fine. But unfortunately, fortunately, I haven't found anything much better than Photoshop for pixel art. Largely, that's just because Photoshop has been around for decades, and so it gets the core tools of just manipulating your canvas and selections and stuff right, where a lot of newer pixel editors that try to do specifically, you know, sprite art for games, they have all the right intentions, and they have, like, they have the workflow set up in a way that's really good for games, but then they just haven't been around long enough to have that, like, that basic, you know, foundation of really good tools for just moving around and, you know, putting pixels on canvas. So maybe in a while, but maybe not. It's just like, even if there were an excellent tool, I wouldn't uninstall Photoshop because I do so many different kinds of design. So I feel like I'm stuck with Photoshop for the rest of my life.
It's so crazy that like I often ask people, because I, you know, I use Photoshop too on a regular basis, and it's a tool I know, and I know it for certain types of tasks, and for basic, you know, it's not intended, it was never originally intended for doing any kind of art. It wasn't
sure.
Definitely not pixel art, and not iOS app designs, obviously. It was a photo tool, it's right in the name, but, you know, we all know it, and it's so insanely featureful that it just ends up being a pretty good solution to basically any graphics problem.
Yeah, and then, you know, with the ability to script it and to run, like, you know, batch scripts, and to have actions and, you know, panels and stuff like that, you can make it do basically anything nowadays. I do use a lot of, you know, actions and stuff for specifically for pixel art. Again, if I didn't have them, I'd survive. But yeah, again, if I went to another tool, I'd immediately start missing that. And then I'd be that guy who's complaining that the version 1.0 of a tool doesn't have, you know, UI scripting and whatnot, which is, of course, insane to expect of an app.
Yeah, but, you know, you talk to, you know, Gus Mueller or any of the people who maintain, you know, competing mm-hmm. graphics tools, their inbox, I'm sure, is as far as you can scroll of people asking for obscure Photoshop features that no one but them uses.
Yeah, and all of those people, of course, want to use Acorn, Gus's tool, because Photoshop is too bloated. And
right.
All of those people are asking for the three features that they need. And, of course, there's 10,000 other people who need three other features. So.
Yeah. And if you implement them all, then it's just as bad as Photoshop. And, yeah, go to the next thing.
Exactly. It's not like, you know, Adobe is filled with people who are just thinking up features nobody needs. They put it in there because a lot of people ask.
So is there anything that's particularly annoying or challenging about pixel art other than just, you know, the style of it?
I mean, there are problems that you run into, you know, not enough pixels is the classic problem. You know,
sure.
When you're stuck in a situation where you're going to have to design a font that's, you know, 3x5, and they're just letters that you can't execute in that, and so
Inman was saying that it's like there's no M
letter
that's
M, yeah.
four characters wide or less. It's just there's no way you can make it look like an M.
Yeah, but and then of course, but the triumph of pixel art is then an hour later he posted a photo of him doing just that.
Just that.
I mean, if you and the genius of his solution is that. No, if you just put that one letter M on the screen, you wouldn't guess what it was. But if you put it in a word, your brain is really good at finding the word shape and going, oh, that must be an M, of course. And I mean, that's how all like heavily stylized fonts work. You just have to rely on context. So that happens in pixel art a lot, where you just sort of, you know, you have to fudge things and make them look like something that there's no way they're going to be able to look like in 5 pixels. And then matching your own style is also quite difficult because of this first problem where sort of you decide, okay, all of my characters are going to have a black stroke, like a black outline around the shape. And then you're super happy with that until you're not, until you get to that one point where you're going, oh, you know, if I drop the stroke here, it would look better. And then you sort of have to quickly make the decision, well, is it okay to make an exception here or not? And the same thing happens with if you're sticking to, like you tell yourself, you know what, I'm going to use the classic NES color palette. And then you use that, and then you come to a point where, you know, you need an orange between, you know, your orange and a yellow, and it just doesn't exist. And so what do you do now? And so it takes this sort of discipline of saying, well, then I just don't do it. I do it some other way. I'm guilty of just you know, inventing a new orange in that case, which isn't always the best solution. Whereas somebody like Sean Inman, he will absolutely not do that. He's like, he's hardcore. He has to stick to the actual retro thing.
What do you think? Like, what's the trade-off there? Because for definitely I've seen a pretty big variation in between games like being extreme and like, we're going to use the CGA color palette and it's just going to look bad because games were looked bad in that time, you know? Yeah. And then other times it's just like, well, you know, we're going to make it look pixely, but, you know, kind of. And like, obviously somewhere in between is probably the right balance, but like, what was your thinking on?
I think somewhere in between is the right balance, but the question of where in between is really tricky because so the incident, our first game, sort of obeyed a lot of the like pixel rules of, you know, looking like an old game. But then it did one thing, which is absolutely not true to that, which is that our sprites can rotate freely. And they rotate in such a way that the pixels rotate with them. So we don't get like garbled pixels, like the whole thing rotates. Because the pixels are big enough on like a nice retina screen, it looks good to me. So it doesn't bug me. But I'm sure there are a lot of people whom it bugs. One thing that bugs me incredibly, I will almost not play a game if it does this, is when they use mixed pixel sizes. So they have really big pixels and then they need to do text and they realize they can't do big pixels. So they just switch to smaller pixels. That freaks me out. I can't be okay with that. So yeah, it's just sort of like, where do you draw the line? One style that's very popular now, has been for a few years, is pixel art, but with gradients instead of solid colors. And people who do that well, is it Super Brothers of Sword and Sorcery?
Yeah, Sword and Sorcery guys.
Their art looks incredible, but they totally do that. They do gradients on pixel shapes. The other thing is something like Ridiculous Fishing. Is that pixel art? They're not even squares, and yet the spirit of pixel art is clearly there. It's a mosaic just with a different shape with, you know, hexagons instead of squares. So I guess that's where individual style comes from, like where in between you are. If you're sticking to the you know, like CGA thing 100%, I find that that's a little, like, it's limiting in a way that's not necessarily productive. And then if anything goes, if you're not limited by anything, then yeah, again, there's no room for your style there.
That's something you really got to walk a careful line with retro gaming, both from an art standpoint and from a game design standpoint, is a lot of retro games want to sort of buy into the conceit of you could have made this game on the old hardware, but at the same time, you want a few new elements, right? Like something like The Incident as a good example. You totally could have made a game with that gameplay style on, you know, on the hardware that art would have looked at home on. But it wouldn't have been the same game because you couldn't have done those physics objects like that.
Yeah.
That would have just been past the capability to have those objects bouncing off each other and rotating nicely and settling. But my guess is you could have made a pretty fun game with exactly that same gameplay pitch, right? Of there's stuff falling from the sky and you need to dodge around it and jump on top of it and climb up.
But it would be more Tetris-like.
But yeah, it'd be a lot more Tetris blocks dropping than physics objects dropping. And you know, all retro games have to kind of walk that line, right? You don't want to do something that's totally ridiculous that couldn't have been done on that hardware. But if it could have been done on that hardware, maybe, you know, maybe there's going to be things about it that will seem too simple to a modern audience, either visually or in terms of gameplay, right? Like, I don't think people would have connected with something like The Incident as much if it was like that game that you could have made with the same gameplay hook, you know, 20 years ago, because it would have just seemed weird to have these supposedly real things falling straight down and sitting perfectly straight and stuff like that. Like it would have seemed strange.
Yeah, I think one trick that you have to use is that people's memory of these games, even people who are, you know, huge fans of whatever, you know, Super Mario Brothers 2, they haven't played it in 20 years. And you have to tap into not what the game is, but what people's memory of the game is. And the game is always way more awesome in your memory than it actually was. So, like, if you remember the Contra theme song from the game, right? It's like three channels, you know, really poor sounding. But like when you hear that in your brain, it's like this really badass, like, you know, shredding
symphony
guitar. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So when you hear like cover bands now cover that, like, you know, with a full band, that's, you're like, yes, that's exactly it. That's how I heard it in my brain. It sounds more like the thing than the thing itself. And so with, you know, you were saying with the physics in the incident, your brain almost remembers Mario as having full physics. Mario so does not have full physics, right? But that's how you remember it. And so it just feels more natural, because for a real world to have, you know, real physics, of course, feels natural to your brain. So the other thing that I remember is back in the 80s, I was playing something on my Commodore 64 or something, and a friend came over, and it was like a driving game, and he would pick up the joystick, and he would, of course, tilt the entire joystick left and right to turn. And we were all laughing at him because, you know, you don't have to do that. You just, you know, tilt the actual stick, but the base can stay, you know, solid. But in a sense, he was right in that his natural instinct was correct. And so nowadays, when you pick up like an iPad or iPhone and you tilt the whole device, like, yeah, that's natural. That's what you want to do. So if you make a game today that uses tilt controls, you know, it's almost tapping into that original instinct that, you know, you want to tilt the whole, you know, joystick or gamepad instead of just pushing on the button on it.
I think that's a lot of what makes like the retro game aesthetic and all the indie games that are coming out like this really interesting and fun, is that we can go back to the well of these sort of gameplay styles and the look and the feel of some of these and the sound of some of these older games, but we can bring in new capabilities with either physics or our, you know, new things, like things that we've just learned about game design, that, hey, it turns out that like having a checkpoint pretty frequently,
yes,
and not just like killing you and you're,
yes,
like, okay, you start at the beginning and it's like, you know, welcome to, you're a space explorer. Like, you'd be like, wow, whatever, screw this. Like now, whereas at the time we were sort of originally taught to like, well, if you die, you start over the beginning. That's the way games work. And having that stuff woven back into some of these old things breathes a lot of new life into them in a way that, you know, it would be really frustrating and ridiculous if we tried to build new, completely retro games without having learned from 20 years of game design.
On the other hand, you do get a certain amount of, with the visual style of the old games, you can also signal that you're going to be a bit of a throwback in terms of gameplay style, that you're not necessarily going to modernize everything, and that people shouldn't go into it with the same expectations that they'd have of a modern game, right? That, you know, you can look at some of the retro games and say, like, you know, if they went and made this with like all super realistic graphics and like everything was just top-notch production values, it seem a bit thin, you know, like it, mm-hmm, wouldn't have the same things that you expect story and gameplay wise from a modern game, and so it would seem really like empty and strange, whereas you bring the retro style in and people are going into it with a different mindset of, they're not expecting the same experience that they're getting from a modern photorealistic kind of title, and are able to relax and suspend their disbelief on some things that might bug them in a more modern style game.
Yeah, that's a great point, because, you know, if you imagine like Flappy Bird, if that were a 3D rendered, you know, photorealistic bird flying over like a realistic landscape, it would seem almost like a joke, right? Like, why did you go to all this effort for a game that, you know, has a single interaction and, like, you know, is just an endless runner? So yeah, retro is one style that lets you sort of signal to people, this is, I call that clever more than like, you know, having production values. Like, you have a clever idea for a game. So yeah, retro style signals that, or the other style is what's called like minimalist, you know, where it's kind of just like flat geometric shapes. And that also lets people know, like, this is going to be a thing that's very much has like a core mechanic, and that's what the game is about. It's not about unlocking a million different things and playing it for, you know, 3 months.
Yeah, and that's generally with indie, well, Obviously, indie games tend towards being shorter, smaller games. Retro games often, and retro style tends to signify that it's a shorter, smaller game. But one of the things that I think, or the impression I got with Space Age, that one of the original thoughts behind it was, like, let's try something more ambitious than a, like, you know, 10-minute little, you know, like than a puzzle game or something, something with a full sort of story. Do you see a lot of other retro style games doing that kind of thing, or do you think that that's a sort of a novel thing?
I think Sword and Sorcery was the first game on iOS, at least, that I saw that was kind of like that. It's not just that it's trying to be, you know, kind of, you know, story driven, but also that there's no like core mechanic to it. The thing that you do on the first screen is nothing like the thing that you do on the second screen, and so on. So it's not easy to describe what the mechanic of it is. It's more about like the discovery of, let's see what all happens in this game. When you think about adventure games, like LucasArts type adventure games, a lot of what we remember is like, oh yeah, those are the games where you solve puzzles. But it's not entirely clear what a puzzle is in those games. Because, you know, you have dialogue trees, you have inventory, you can combine things. You can, you know, combine inventory and dialogue at the same time. There are like map type things. There's like find the hidden object in the room. There's kind of like a flowchart type puzzles in the sense do this, then do that, then do the other thing, then wait, and then do the next thing. So a lot of those games, I think, are about not so much about a mechanic, but about how many different things can we get the player to do, and can we sort of manipulate the player's expectations of what's possible at any given point in the game? And so Space Age tries to do a little bit of that, of like, you know, we're going to give you some simple ways to interact with the game, but at some point we're going to have to basically stop and go like, you know, at this point you have to do something that you haven't done yet, and we are not going to show you a hint or whatever. We just want to try different things that might work in this game. And some of them might be things that so far you've thought, oh, clearly I can't do that, but maybe you can do it if you try it here. So, I'm not sure I have like a great name for that kind of game, but story-driven games tend to have that, because stories, just by their nature, sort of have arcs and are complicated and have a lot of different interactions. So it's hard to tell a story through a single mechanic. If that makes sense.
To me, Space Age definitely seems like an adventure game. Like that's mm-hmm. the thing that it reminded me the most of from what I've played of it so far. It's certainly not the same in terms of the exact gameplay mechanics. Like it doesn't have that very traditional adventure game look of sort of single screen areas that you're walking through and large characters and lots of emphasis on inventory management, but right. definitely from a feel standpoint, adventure games are what it seems to be the closest to me, that it's got that, you know, you've got that sort of looking around at things and trying to figure out how things are working, and not much that depends on really serious twitch action, at least not so far. Maybe there is later in the game. I've only played, I think, 5 or 6 missions into it, but
that's a very fair description. And we tried, but partly this happens because if you're doing a story-driven game with multiple characters and with dialogue, you end up writing. Matt wrote this editor that we use to actually build the game. And that editor has a lot of different logic, you know, in points and out points and, you know, kind of flow management stuff. And once you have that, you sort of start thinking about what all does this let us do? We certainly could have made a game like Space Age that looks exactly like Space Age and has like a single mechanic where like all you're doing is dialogue trees, or all you're doing is like using, you know, objects. But as we sort of kept adding things, you know, we kept asking ourselves sort of like, okay, the player has done, you know, all of these things so far. What can we now ask them to do that, you know, that is totally possible with the engine that we have, but that they haven't done before? And as for the adventure feel of it, yeah, that was definitely something that we wanted to do. I mean, the first thing that Matt and I talked about before we did the incident was doing an adventure game. And at that time, we were thinking of very much a, like, LucasArts type thing. Matt was writing an engine that was essentially a clone of Scum, the engine that LucasArts used for Monkey Island and games of that sort. But I had seen a few games of that sort on iOS, and it never quite worked for me. Those games were very much made for you know, mouse input. And also, whenever Matt and I talk about game ideas, my first thought is, okay, what does a game like that look like on iOS? iOS is sort of our current focus in terms of platform. And when we talk about game ideas, we sort of try not to limit ourselves to just that. But then once we have picked an idea that sounds good, we sort of go, okay, but how does that look on iOS? And so that sort of also influenced a lot of how Space Age is an adventure game, but yeah, doesn't quite have the UI or the interactions of a typical, you know, classical 1990s adventure game, maybe.
Well, typing would feel pretty gross, I think.
Oh,
popping up a keyboard, like.
Oh yeah, and even dialogue trees, like every time we mocked that up, it's just kind of weird. It takes you out of the game so much. We really didn't want to take you out of the game. We wanted a cinematic feel, and so the idea of, like, you know, something happening and then you getting, you know, dialogue choice, which essentially fills up the whole screen, it just sort of felt wrong for this game anyway.
Though I find that the non-text-based adventure games translate pretty well to the iPad. Like, I quite enjoyed replaying the Monkey Island games on the iPad. Like, I thought it was a really good platform for those. In some ways, it felt even a little more natural than the mouse and the keyboard, because you get that real, like, tactile sense of things from actually touching the stuff. And I didn't feel like it damaged the experience at all. That's, I think, probably for me, the biggest bummer about LucasArts folding is that they're not going to do that to the rest of them, probably. Like, I was quite looking forward to seeing, like, the other two classic Monkey Island games and maybe Loom and stuff like that coming back, and, you know, probably that won't happen now. But I thought that the two Monkey Island games that they did the iPad redos of actually were quite excellent in terms of how well they played on the iPad.
That's definitely true. And I mean, Monkey Island is such a huge game in this whole world of, you know, of adventure games, that, you know, if somebody told me that they had written a port of it in, you know, in Twine, that, you know, texty choose your own adventure engine, I would totally buy that. If people made it as a first person shooter, I would understand, just because that, like, people who know that game know every single puzzle and every single screen and every single line of dialogue. And it's just one of those things. It's like the Big Lebowski or Caddyshack. Like, if you know it, you know every single thing about it. And that's why all of these, like, derivatives come out. Speaking of, like, the Big Lebowski, you know, there's like a whole cottage industry of people doing, like, the Big Lebowski if it had been written by Shakespeare, you know, or whatever. So it's just like, when the thing becomes so big, it's like the Bible. You know, you can do anything with it. You can make it do or say anything. So yeah, porting Monkey Island to iOS totally works. Doing a new game that's in that style, that maybe a slightly different challenge. I don't know.
Speaking of first-person shooter Monkey Island, there is someone has done that.
There's a
great, I'm just getting the link here to put in the show notes. There's a great CryEngine demo that's like a couple of scenes from Monkey Island 2. Like, it's not a full game. It's just a visual thing, but it's well worth a look for anyone who's a fan of the Monkey Island games. Put it in the chat there, and you can stick it in the show notes for people who are interested in checking that out.
Seems like CryEngine would be a little bit overkill, Greg.
Well, I think the thing about CryEngine that makes it good for that kind of stuff is it's got a very accessible editor, from what I understand. I haven't used it or its main competition, Unreal, at all myself, because we always did our own engine tech at Radical, but from what I understand, the Crytek engine is really easy to get really good results in quickly, just because they've got a lot of cool tools for sculpting landscape and placing foliage and stuff like that. That I imagine probably Unreal's caught up to them to some degree now, but there was a period there where if you wanted to build some quick, cool thing and didn't have a lot of knowledge, were just sort of starting from scratch, that it was a good engine to do that stuff in. So
awesome. So I want to do a little sponsor, and then I'm interested to talk about the appeal of retro games. So this episode is brought to you by Retro Game Crunch. Retro Game Crunch is actually a project started by Sean Inman, who we'd mentioned before, trying to make M's that were 4 pixels. But it started as a Ludum Dare game jam, which ended up leading to a successful Kickstarter to build 6 brand new retro games. And they actually ended up packaging in a 7th, which is the game that they did in the game jam. So they built platformers, shoot 'em up, beat 'em up. All of the 'em ups are present in the package. So if you're interested in supporting indie games, they have a successful Steam Greenlight campaign, but I don't believe the game's up on Steam yet, but that doesn't stop you from getting it, because you can buy it today at retrogamecrunch.com. So the thing that I wanted to sort of touch on, we talked a bit about what drives the sort of supply of retro games, you know, various things that, you know, well, obviously we like them and, you know, game developers enjoy the aesthetic and, you know, the lower overhead of compared to creating all of New York City in 3 dimensions. But the appeal of it to gamers, like, obviously it's not just that people like to make them, like, you know, people who are buying games are buying them and they're playing them and they're very much enjoying them. And something that obviously comes into question is, like, how much of the of people's adoration for the aesthetic is nostalgia for games that they previously have played, and how much of it is the actual features and benefits and just the nice things about the graphics and the music and sound in those kind of games.
I think a huge amount of it is the nostalgia, but I don't know how much that generalizes. Like, I think that's a big part of it for me. That's the thing that I sort of warm up to about those games, is that it's a throwback to, like, the NES, SNES days. But the style seems to have stayed popular to a degree that I don't think can be entirely explained by that, because I wouldn't think that people 10 or 15 years younger than me would have that same sense of nostalgia for those games. And the games that they would have a sense of nostalgia for don't seem to be as popular from a retro gaming standpoint. Like, the early 3D games, for the most part, have not had any sort of resurgence in that style, right? Like, you don't see games, for the most part, aping the style of, like, the original Wolfenstein or Doom or
Tomb Raider,
Ultima Underworld, or the first couple Tomb Raiders, like
Crash Bandicoot.
Yeah, so the fact that the 8-bit style has held on, it kind of leads me to believe that there must be something about those aesthetics that is genuinely appealing, even to people who it isn't nostalgia for, even though I feel like for me personally, the nostalgia is probably most of it.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this because, like you said, yeah, for myself it's probably nostalgia. I grew up like in that exact time, and so I always think, like, well, I'm just biased. But like you said, you know, 7-year-olds love that stuff. They love Minecraft. Why do they think Minecraft looks cool in addition to being a cool game to play, right? And I have, I know a lot of people are going to be angry at me for saying this, but like, maybe there is such a thing as, like, a golden era, like, even, you know, in terms of, like, game mechanics and gameplay and style, that when you hit that point, like, that's a really good place to be in. And then after that, you maybe sort of start losing some things. And I know that sounds crazy, because we all like to believe that things only ever get better. And of course, a game comes out like, you know, like BioShock or Portal, and you're like, you know, they never would have had this in the 80s. This is amazing. And it is, but most games today don't amaze me. I was thinking about this, and an analogy I have is to music. So like in the 1950s and 60s, everybody agrees that music was awesome, right? Like, you know, rock and roll was great. You know, you all you needed was 4 people, you know, and you know, two or three guitars and a drum kit, and you could write music that people still listen to today. And that sort of music was largely simple. I mean, something like, you know, the Beach Boys, Monkees, you know, the Beatles, you know, and even the Rolling Stones. Like, it's the same. They're using the same kinds of instruments, and the songs all have, you know, five chords max in them. And they're verse, chorus, verse. But it works. And then you get into, like, the late 60s and 70s, and people start throwing in, you know, all of those bands and all the bands after them start throwing in, you know, synth stuff and you know, an orchestra and brass and everything. And so towards the late 70s, you have this explosion of, like, you know, it all culminates in, like, in prog rock, where basically you're going to be writing these symphonic, you know, 17-minute songs. And everybody who's doing that at that moment thinks, yes, music is advancing. Like, this is exactly what should happen, you know.
But try playing one of those songs to somebody that's, like, 18 now. And right. They're like, what hell is this?
And that's why it all collapses. Come the 80s, it sort of resets a bit again. And then you get the same thing happening in the 80s. This sort of, like production sort of starts taking over, you know, with, like, spandex metal bands that spend millions on an album. And then Nirvana comes out, and it's like, no, you actually need, you know, two guitars and four people, and that's it. And so I feel like that sort of cycle happens a lot in all kinds of media. And so maybe that's kind of the thing that happens with games, where, like, that, like, you know, like, late 80s, early 90s period was really, like, the technology that we had and the creative constraints were really productive. And then, like, towards the mid and late 90s, yeah, you start getting the early 3D stuff, which, like you said, just does not look good. Nobody looks at Tomb Raider now and goes, wow, do you remember those awesome old graphics? No, it just looks like garbage. It's, like, gray and broken up and then, you know, jagged.
Well, in Tomb Raider, we mentioned this last week when we were talking about game controllers on iOS. I got one of these game controllers, and one of the games I downloaded to play with it was the original Tomb Raider. And the thing that bugged me the most about it wasn't the graphics. Like, I knew the graphics were going to be bad. I was expecting the graphics to be bad. And, you know, it's not something you can be as nostalgic about as, like, the 8-bit style, but something you can be a little nostalgic about. The thing with Tomb Raider that was just killing me was the controls. The controls are all the, like, character relative tank style controls that were like the thing in that era. And to modern sensibilities, that control scheme just does not hold up. Once you've played a game with good camera relative controls, like a third-person action game, you cannot go back to a character relative control. Like, it's just, it's ridiculous, right? And I mean, not all games from that era have that problem. Like, there were camera relative games from that era as well. I mean, that was the same time that the N64 was out, and you had, like, Mario 64, which is probably the first game that really started to nail, like, the modern camera relative style. But I mean, Tomb Raider just completely fell down on that, and now it's, you know, now it gets kind of unplayable from a control standpoint. One thing I just to jump back to what you were saying about music, that a sort of interesting point related to that is, I think part of what's different about games from other art forms is that other art forms, the real old stuff tends to hold up a lot better, right? Like, if you like music from the 50s or the 30s, you can go and get those recordings and listen to them, and they're still good music, right? Like, guitars haven't gotten technologically better to a degree that most listeners are going to care about since those eras. And yeah, recording technology has gotten better, but recording technology then was still capable of reproducing the sound at a pretty good fidelity. So, you know, you can go back and listen to that music, and music's something that's got replayability value. You know, if you like a particular artist, you're going to be willing to listen to their songs over and over again. Games don't have that going for them. The games from that nostalgia kind of era, even though they had a lot of things to recommend them in terms of, like you said, the sort of simplicity and focus of the gameplay, there's, you know, the technology was primitive, and there's things about those games that we can do better with modern technology. And you can't necessarily go and replay the old games the same way that you can listen to, like, a Duke Ellington record 100 times. You know, you can't really go back and play a lot of those classic games that much. So if you've got that nostalgia, the only way to get your fix of it is to make new games that follow that style rather than going back to the originals.
Well, you can. That's actually something that's changed recently with the virtual console and these sort of things. Like in previous generations, like there's just no way, once you retired your NES and it either wasn't working or it's not plugged in anymore, you can't play your NES games anymore. Whereas now, just in the last couple of generations, is becoming not 100%, but it's getting closer to that any previous hit game can be played again in either emulation on just on download on piracy or whatever, or on the virtual consoles provided by like Sony and Nintendo. And so it actually does give the opportunity for people in new generations to experience old games. Like you're saying, Nigel, that your son was playing Earthbound, which is a game that I would never even think of as someone going back to that has, it was too young for it. But, you know, it's a story-based game that's, you know, the gameplay is not, like we say, the broken 3D camera model that would drive him crazy. It's, you know, it's a top-down RPG, and so it stands up and he loves it.
Yeah, we have at the Panic Office, we have an actual NES with a CRT TV set up, and Earthbound is one of the games that gets played quite a bit on that. Yeah, it's interesting. In terms of like emulators and you know, remasters of games, which is one thing that happens a lot on iOS now, you can play them. It's not quite the same. When I said that, like at Panic, we took the trouble to find an actual small CRT TV on the little, you know, legs that you have to sit on the floor to play. That's the only acceptable way to play NES games.
If it doesn't have the little wooden legs, then it's no good.
Right. Yeah. It's not. Yeah. That doesn't. On a, playing NES on an like a LCD TV, that's just outrageous. But so we did all of that, and you know, if you play it on a, you know, like an iOS port, it's not quite the same thing. But you mentioned something about Duke Ellington. One thing that happened with jazz from that era is that people thought that listening to a jazz recording was just the worst thing in the world. Of course, you have to see jazz live, but and then it took a few decades, and people are like, nah, actually, it's fine if you listen to it, you know, if you listen to a record. And then, of course, CDs come out, and people like Neil Young freak out. You have to listen to it on vinyl. And so
you need the Pono
ultra death. Right, right.
No, don't start on the vinyl stuff.
Right.
Excellent podcast got sucked into that tar pit for like 3 weeks. No one say the word vinyl again.
Yeah. I'm just saying, I agree, the best way to hear Duke Ellington is to hear him live. However, none of us have the opportunity to do that. So then maybe if recordings are, you know, actually a fine way to hear them. So, you know, if I bought this NES so that my daughter, who is now 3, can play, you know, those games the way they're meant to be played. By the time she has kids, it's going to be impossible to play this stuff with physical controls. So, you know, if they play it on their, you know, Oculus Rift or Google Glass or whatever, that's fine. That's still probably a decent compromise.
It's better than nothing, right. But I don't know. I think Mario 3 and Oculus Rift would feel different. It would feel pretty strange, I think.
Well, and you definitely can. Like, what I was saying before wasn't so much that you can't play those games, you know, in a modern environment. Like, yeah, you can bring them up to date and play them. More, I think the issue with games is they don't have the replayability or rewatchability that other art forms that you would get nostalgic about do. If someone likes Duke Ellington, they'll listen to, you know, a particular Duke Ellington record dozens, if not hundreds of times, and be totally happy with that. Whereas the vast majority of people won't replay a classic NES game more than once or twice. And if you're nostalgic for that sort of thing, like, yeah, you go on Virtual Console and you get the game and you play it and you're like, all right, I want more of that, but I don't want to play that thing again. And where do you turn? And that's, I think, a big chunk of where nostalgia feeds into these modern retro games. It gives people that are into that style of gaming a new fix that they can't get once they've tapped out the libraries that are available of the actual games from that era.
Awesome. Well, I think that's a great coverage of the topic. So thanks for listening, everybody, and huge thanks to Nevin for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been fun.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. So if you'd like to find out when Space Age launches, unless you have any inside information for us, Nevin, that you want to announce right now on this show.
It's entering beta testing this week, and beta testing takes however long it takes. So sorry.
Until it's good, yeah. Which is actually...
So it should be out sometime in 2014.
That's...
Hopefully.
Yes,
unless you get a lot of feedback.
Yes, it's going to be in 2014. I'll say that. I'm going to promise that.
Excellent. So if you'd like to find out exactly when it's available, you can visit spaceageapp.com and sign up for their mailing list, or follow Space Age App on Twitter. See you next week.
So, you know, once again, not being a news podcast, we don't generally deal with current news, but we have to talk about the biggest announcement in gaming this week, which is, of course, that they've finally resolved the rights situation on No One Lives Forever, which means that there's a chance we're going to see a re-release of it.
Oh, nice.
So that's pretty exciting.
I don't actually even know what that is.
It's... only like the best first person shooter ever made.
Yeah. It's very interesting. It's a cult game for sure, right? Would you say?
Oh yeah, it's a serious cult game.
Yeah.
So it has the sound of a James Bond game.
Yes.
It's not a James Bond game.
Yeah. It's not a James Bond game, but it's definitely in the like 60s spy genre.
Right. So I'm looking at this, and this is like a sort of 3D shooter. Like, it's, I guess, 14 years old, PlayStation 2 era, which to me sounds like a classic type of game that everyone's like, oh man, it was so amazing. And then when you actually play it, like if you play GoldenEye now, it just ruins your memory. You're like, this is terrible. You don't actually have the controls that you expect on a game like that anymore. And of course the graphics are terrible. Like, so are they doing a remake based on the IP and the story, which was really good, or
there's nothing official yet? So the big thing with it is no one could figure out like who owned it. Huh. So there was a big, you know, it was one of these situations where there was a developer and a publisher, and the developer was bought out by some other company, and it wasn't clear exactly. And it never gotten even like a good old games release or anything like that, I don't think. So, and it was just like no one could figure out like who's got these rights. Who would we even talk to if we wanted to republish these games? And then just this week, someone surfaced who seems to believe that they have the rights to publish it, that they've purchased those rights from whoever actually owned it. And so there's a chance that we're going to see either just like a release of the game, the original games themselves, or some new stuff with that license, either of which would be super awesome.
Yeah, I would say that in terms of like how playable the game is today, it's better than you think. It's better than GoldenEye. And, you know, graphics aren't great, but if they did a new thing, like the best things about that game are like the story and the fun of it, and sort of like the interesting setting. So I think if they just did a new game and they kept that spirit, it would totally be compelling.
Yeah. And it's one of those games, it's new enough that it holds up, right? Like, it's not in the valley of them just starting to figure out 3D technology where things were actually bad for a while there. Like, you had a bit of a regression in terms of gameplay quality from the best of the sprite-based games. It was into modern first-person shooters. Like, yeah, it's a little blocky and polygonal and stuff like that, but it's got modern FPS controls and style, and the graphics are acceptable and stuff like that. I've replayed... it's one of the few games that I've gone back and replayed, like, multiple times, just because I enjoy it so much. And it's been a while. I don't think I've done it since I had my new computer, because I didn't set up boot camp on my newest computer, but my previous computer, I definitely played it once on that. So that was no more than 4 years ago, the last time I played it, and I still quite enjoyed it. I mean, for me, part of that is going to be nostalgia, because it's a game that I've enjoyed so much. But
do you have any games, you know, obviously you're busy making Space Age. So I don't know if you've been, but if you have, you have any games you've played in the last while that you've been excited about or that you've hated and you want to warn us all off of?
I'm very excited about a game coming out in not soon at all, but Firewatch, obviously.
Of course.
I have to mention that. Panic, where I work, we're sort of producing a game made by some ex-Telltale Games people. It's called Firewatch. You may have heard of it in the, you know, game circles. So
I own the t-shirt.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, it's a good one. Yeah. Yeah, everything I've seen of that looks amazing, so I'm genuinely interested to see what happens with that. What have I played lately? Gosh, like you said, I've been so busy with, you know, actually Space Age that that's what I've spent all my time on. I played an iOS game called Paradox Factor. Have you heard of that?
No.
It's a small game, a little choose your own adventure type game. Totally like, you know, read a page of text, choose from, you know, three options after. But it, so with those games, I always want to love those games and I never truly love them because I feel like it always feels kind of artificial that like that I'm choosing what happens next. Like it doesn't feel like it belongs in the world
of
whatever.
You want to marry her or kill her?
Yeah.
Those are your only options.
Yeah, yeah. And it always feels like, who's deciding this? Why do I get to control the future? Like it's kind of odd. And this game sort of mechanically decides to provide a valid reason for why you can choose what happens next. I'm just going to say there's a time machine involved, which is, of course, you know, the biggest sort of, you know, savor of writers' lives to, you know, just add a time machine because then you can do anything. But it does it in a clever way. So I enjoyed that. For it's like for the cleverness of being able to take that old mechanic and then just through the introduction of the time machine sort of make it feel like it actually belongs there.
Yeah, it looks like it's a pretty texty oriented game.
Yeah, don't expect amazing or compelling graphics.
Yeah, but I mean, I would imagine some, like, not having played Paradox Factor, I mean, people who maybe like Black Bar as being like text oriented, maybe would also like.
I would say so. When people have been kind enough to tell me that they like Black Bar and, you know, what should they play next, I've been recommending Paradox Factor because it sort of feels similar. That and Device 6 are sort of feel to me like they're kind of from the same universe.
If for anyone who doesn't know what Black Bar is, do you want to give like the brief?
Yeah, Black Bar is a quick little text game that I made with the help of my friend James Moore last August. It was sort of just like a, I don't want to say overnight, but like a 2-week project where I had this idea for a really simple game that would contain nothing but text. And so the mechanic in that game is it's based on the idea of censorship of like redacted letters. So the entire game is, and it's an iOS game, is you're reading a series of letters, and the letters have been redacted. So some words have been, you know, blacked out, basically. And you essentially have to guess, well, I'll use the word guess, though. You really have to sort out, you know, using your brain, what the word might be. And when you do so, then you can, you know, proceed to the next letter and so on. And so a story sort of unravels from that. That was my own kind of personal experiment in, can you take something like text games and provide a mechanic that sort of that fits in that world?
I'm surprised to hear it. I didn't realize it was a short kind of 2-week sort of project because it got a lot of attention from that I saw.
It still feels crazy to me where like when we were done with it, it sort of all happened in like this tornado of just of quick coding that like I barely even remember writing half of it. But it was totally an idea that I just had sort of like at night, and then it sort of kept me up. And then in the morning, like as I was showering, I kind of had another idea where I was like, yeah, I think this could work. And it's so simple on like on a you know programming basis that like I could just sit down and bang out a prototype in an hour, and I was like, yeah, this actually feels compelling. And after that point, all it took was for me to sort of like, as I was on the bus or riding my bike or whatever, I would get ideas for different, you know, puzzles and just write them down. And yeah, really, it took no more than 2 weeks to actually to put it together after that. I also really wanted to just do something that was about writing. I wanted to like write a game more than like program a game. So it was also an experiment in that. I was blown away that it got any attention at all. I approached my friend James Moore about actually, you know, coding it for iOS, since I wouldn't know where to begin with that. And so he did that. And I told him, I was like, look, this is going to sell like 300 copies ever, you know, so don't expect to like make money on this. But
thanks for working with me on it.
Right, exactly. I mean, and yeah. And he was like, yeah, whatever. You know, it's just like, you know, a little... He seemed to like the game, so he was like, "Yeah, you know, I think it should exist, so let's make it." And then, you know, it sold way better than we expected. I mean, it ended up like in Wired and in the New York Times on their list of like, you know, best games of the year and whatnot. So I have no idea how any of that happened. It's all a mystery to me.
Well, that's a really particularly notable, because when something gets in the New York Times, people assume, oh, well, they must have had a big PR firm.
Yeah,
they had like Hobnob buy some people some drinks. They get in. Sure. No, this is just like you made this thing in 2 weeks and it was good and it was novel and it was different and it got people's attention, and like the internet sort of has now enabled good stuff to rise to the top organically, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, the thing that made me happiest about it was not so much that game did well, but that it sort of proved in some small way that type of game can do well, I guess, because like I've described the game as like App Store poison, because there's nothing attractive about the game. The game is all text. If you look at its screenshots in the store, it's black text on a white screen. And it's not even like particularly designed or anything. It looks like the most boring thing in the world. The icon is just a black and white photo. The description is very brief. I didn't even send out emails to anyone like announcing the game. I put it on my blog and on my Twitter, and that's it. And so like there's no reason why this should have, you know, gotten any number of downloads at all, but it did. And people, you know, but more than that, people seem to genuinely like it, and like people actually like wrote about, you know, like what they think it's about and stuff like that. And so that means that it clicked with them, and I was super happy to see that, like, yeah, you don't have to make a game with, you know, cute animals in the game that, you know, cute animals in a physics engine, basically, which is what, you know, iOS runs on. So yeah, that just sort of felt really good to see that a game that seems like it shouldn't belong on that platform can find its own audience.
We should put in a spoiler alert for that there's no cute animals in.
No, sorry. There, I can... That's going to become pretty obvious about 30 seconds into the game.
As soon as you see the screenshots, I think it's pretty clear.
I don't believe they mention animals either.
So speaking of good iOS games, we talked about it before, but no one had played it at that point. But I have now. Hitman Go is freaking fantastic.
Yeah.
Like way better than it has any right to be, given the high concept pitch. Like... I would not have wanted to be the guy like, all right, we're going to do a turn-based puzzle game with the Hitman license. Like, you would think they would have been laughed out of the office, but instead they made the game, and it is really, really good.
Yep, fully agree.
It's well worth checking out.
Have you played it, Evan?
Yeah. It's really good. Yeah, it's... I had no love for the Hitman franchise before. That's kind of not my style of game. And then I saw that and I'm like, I actually kind of love it because it is Hitman, because it's such an odd fit now. Had these just been like random little characters done as these little scale model figurines, I don't know if I would have liked it as much, but tying it to such a specific IP just makes me laugh. So.
And it really gives it a style. Like it does match the sort of feel of the Hitman games, even though the gameplay is entirely different. There's enough little call-out elements, like the costumes and the two pistols and the sniper rifle and the briefcases. And, like, there's all these elements that, you could make this game with it not even being about killing people from a conceptual standpoint. And it would be the exact same game, but giving it that little bit, just it makes it feel weightier, and it's a really good puzzle game. Like the puzzles are really clever, and having sort of the different objectives on each level that you can't do all of them at the same time, and you have to go back and redo the levels and hit some of the objectives in order to unlock the later levels, because they've got a very aggressive curve on how many sort of points you need to unlock each additional game. So you can't just do like one pass through things and have enough points to unlock the next thing. And yeah, it's a real gem of a game. I was really skeptical about it when I heard about it, and then I saw it and I was like, wow, this looks cool. Like, I have to try this. And then, yeah, tried it, and it's great.